Good morning and welcome to a special edition of A Vision for You. My name is Larry Kay. I'm a recovered compulsive overeater from Chicago. I'm going to host the presentation this morning. Today is Sunday, March 29th, 2026. The share ID numbers for Friday, March 27th are the following: the 7 a.m. Eastern Standard Time meeting. That number is 23,320. That's 23320. The 10 a.m. meeting, 23,321, 23321. This morning, A Vision for You presents From Hypervigilance to Trust. Our presenter is going to share how, over time, her recovery has shifted from trying to control living and trust through daily spiritual practices in a relationship with power. Looking forward to that. You know, I've heard it said that trust generally blossoms in the harshest conditions, you know, born from the ashes of despair. It becomes like a guiding beacon, and it gets us through, you know, these darkest of times. And let's remember that the practical program of spiritual action began to take root, among other things, when Bill W.'s childhood friend, Ebby Thatcher, impressed upon him the need to follow the six tenets from the Oxford Group movement. And I would imagine, I have a sneaking suspicion that Bill was just as skeptical as we were when we arrived, when the spiritual toolkit was offered for our inspection. And what was suggested, you know, what was it, I guess, suggested that he trust? And the Oxford Group six steps at that time were a complete deflation, dependence on God, a moral inventory, confession, restitution, and then continued work with others in need, kind of a service deal as well. And Bill was entirely lacking in medical training. He transcribed these divinely inspired steps by putting notes together from religion and philosophy and all the things and massaging them into a succinct list and a structure. And was it divinely inspired? Well, I don't know. I choose to believe that it was. And much like many of us, Bill was lifted up from the ashes of despair and hopelessness in his alcoholism to a life worth living. And I can't say what this trust meant for Bill better than he can. He says, you know, my drinking assumed more serious proportions, continuing all day and almost every night. And on the desperation, he says, liquor ceased to be a luxury. It turned into a necessity. And then on the mental state, there was a terrible sense of impending calamity. And then the spiritual turning point for him. Why, you know, Ebby says, why don't you trust your own conception of God? And then this idea of surrender. Bill says, I humbly offered myself to God as I then understood him to do with me as he would. And his realization of helplessness, I admitted for the first time that of myself I was nothing, that without him I was lost. And then the result of that surrender, he says, I stood in the sunlight at last. Faith without works is dead. You know, I'm reminded of a quote that captures our indebtedness to those that blaze the trail from despair to trust. And it goes like this. It says, if I have seen further, it is by standing on the shoulders of giants. Now, joining us this morning to share her journey in navigating through the 12 steps and undergoing a spiritual transformation is Lisa B. from South Carolina. And Lisa spells her name L-E-S-A, and she's committed to the 12 steps and the 12 traditions as a way of life. And so it's with much gratitude and affection that we welcome Lisa B. to the line this morning. Good morning, Lisa.
Good morning, Larry. I hope you can hear me. Can you hear me okay?
Perfectly. Perfectly.
Oh, great. Thank you. Thank you so much. Thanks for your service and for the introduction. Thank you, everyone that's doing service and for A Vision for You. My name is Lisa, and I'm a grateful, recovered, compulsive overeater. And I'm grateful for the opportunity to share on A Vision for You. And thank you for asking me. Thank you. Again, I keep saying thank you, but I'm so grateful to A Vision for You. Recently, I was listening to a Sunday special edition talk on Chapter 3, more about alcoholism. And something about it really stayed with me. It helped me see you know, what the whole chapter is about. And I've seen it many times, but I think I began to see it at a deeper level. It helped me see how the disease operates in my thinking long before anything shows up in the food. And I also saw that the same mind that wanted to control the food is the very same mind that wants to try and control life. And around that same time, I began to notice something in my own life. I am abstinent and I feel safe and protected in my recovery. And that's important for me to say because I'm not living in fear going back into the food. But even with that, I began to notice something internally. I was feeling overwhelmed. Not necessarily because of anything extreme happening outside of me, but because of how I was responding inside. And I do want to be clear, it's not that nothing was happening around me. There were changes. We had moved. There were many changes going on. But what really stood out was what was happening inside of me. The level of tension and pressure didn't match what was actually going on. And I could feel myself trying to manage what was going on around me, trying to stay on top of things, trying to figure things out. And there was a kind of tension in all that, almost like I was bracing against life. And what I've come to see in a new and deeper way is that my safety doesn't come from my thinking. It comes from my connection with my higher power. And it doesn't come from my trying to manage on the outside. And what I've been learning is that trust isn't something I can force with my mind. It has come as a result of continuing in the steps as they are laid out in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And through that process, my recovery continues to grow and develop through daily spiritual practice, maintenance, and a relationship with a higher power. So what I want to share about today is how I moved from living in that tension to learning and trust. The same mind that wanted to control food is the same mind that tries to control life. And that's what I found just in this recent chapter. So I'd like to claim my seat before I go further. My first OA meeting was in 1986. I didn't stay at that time. That was one meeting I went to, and I didn't come back until November of 2015, until when I heard about A Vision for You, this amazing OA meeting. So back in 1980, something happened to me that I had not experienced before. I could literally feel myself that I had crossed a line, and it was into binge eating. Prior to that, eating was always recreational. It was fun. It gave me energy. It didn't feel like a problem, and it took the edge off. But at the same time, you know, I was also restricting, compulsively exercising, intensely studying diets and nutrition, and trying to stay underweight so that if I binged, I wouldn't have to worry. But something changed when I stepped over that line. I could literally feel myself crossing over the line. The binge would come on suddenly, and once the thought was there, I had to listen to it. I was like a zombie under its command, and I could not stop. And I also knew that this is something that was not going to go away, that it would be with me for the rest of my life. I would say that was truly my step one experience because I knew I was screwed. Like, I didn't have to have people tell me, "You're in trouble." Like, I knew I was in trouble. This is way, way too powerful for me. And I didn't have language, you know, for that at that time. But today I do understand what my real problem is and was. And I'm jumping around a little bit. So in November of 2015, and I will fill in the gaps here in a moment, but in November of 2015, I introduced myself as a newcomer on this wonderful meeting. And what a gift and what an amazing new chapter for me. And in January of 2016, I began working with my recovered sponsor that I met through A Vision for You. We went to the doctor's opinion where I learned the true nature of my problem and the solution available to me. I went through the 12 steps in a state of entire abstinence. The 12 steps as they're laid out in the big book. And I had a spiritual awakening, and I have been abstinent and recovered since that time. So jumping back to 1986, after I attended my first OA meeting, as I said, I never went back. And shortly after that, I went into a facility for they treated drugs, alcohol, and eating disorders. And I went there for my food. And they did use the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was given a food plan that for me was abstinent. And after I left that treatment facility, that was in March of 1987, I had a food plan and I had structure. And I worshiped the plan and I worshiped the structure. And I had what I call a white knuckle abstinence, but I did not have true internal recovery. I didn't have the spiritual awakening, the personality change that is sufficient to drive out the disease. And I had not worked the steps. So the disease was very active. And eventually, I went back into the food. I walked into the mall. I bought cookies. There was no drama, just a quiet decision. And that was after about 4 or 5 years of a white knuckle abstinence. But really, the decision had been made before I ever walked into the mall and bought the cookies. And then for the next 23 years, I lived as an untreated compulsive overeater and undereater and restrictor. So a typical day for me at that time as an untreated compulsive overeater was very driven. I would exercise for about 2 hours a day, not for health, but for control, trying to manage my body and trying to stay ahead. I also had a problem with compulsive shopping. I lived above my means and was obsessed with my appearance and really what you thought of me. I was trying to feel okay. I was trying to fill something inside of me, and I couldn't name it. Internally, I lived restless, irritable, and very discontented, even when nothing was wrong on the outside. Inside, I was never settled. So my daily experience was from the moment I woke up, I was already thinking about how to manage the day. What would I eat? What would I not eat? How would I exercise? There was no rest. Even when I looked like I had things together inside, I was constantly working in my thoughts, constantly managing, constantly trying to stay ahead of something I didn't understand, and it was exhausting. And I could feel the extremes inside of me. I do believe that I could very easily be a 90-pound anorexic or a 300-pound or more compulsive overeater. And I had no control over which direction it would go. The binges came, and over time, they came closer and closer together. Even when I wasn't binging, my mind was never free. I believed that if things outside of me changed, I would feel better. If my husband would change, if my past changed, if my family changed. And during that time, as I got into my late 40s and early 50s, my favorite brother had died, my mother died, and my stepmother died, and my father died, and I was written out of the will. And I needed open heart surgery. And I had no spiritual foundation to process any of it. And towards the end, right before I came to Vision for You, I was having panic attacks at night. So I'd like to share about the crossroads for me. In 2015, I was recovering from open heart surgery and I was underweight, a lot of it due to the open heart surgery, but also I was underweight before the surgery and the doctors really tried to tell me I really needed to gain some weight before the surgery. It's not healthy to be underweight prior to a surgery like this. And I was standing in an AA meeting. In 1987, by God's grace, I did get sober, and I was standing in an AA meeting. I just want to say I had hoped AA would help me with my food, and it didn't, but that's another story. And a very kind person had put on the walls there in this meeting some 12-step groups that were going to be starting for food. It wasn't OA, but it was another fellowship. And I knew this person that was starting those meetings, and I went up to her to talk with her, and I said, oh, that's great, you know, that's great that you're doing that. I said, I used to have a problem. I used to have a problem with food and eating, but I don't anymore. You know, that just goes to show you the separation from reality. I was in so much denial. And, you know, standing there speaking with her, she looked at me and she said, Lisa, I think you would love A Vision for You. It's an OA meeting and it's just a fabulous meeting. So much recovery based in the big book. And I think you would. And, you know, it was almost like I didn't hear her anymore. She said that initial opening and then I got chills down my neck and my back, which has always been like the way my higher power speaks to me. And I had this moment, my higher power was speaking to me internally. Lisa, if you don't get on that meeting, you're going to have a binge beyond all binges, and you may not come back. You've come to a crossroads. It's like I've outplayed my hand, and I've come to a stop sign, and I have to determine which way I'm going to go. So I knew that I needed to get on to that meeting. I saw in my mind's eye, sinking down to the bottom of the ocean with a weight tied around my waist. And I could feel my higher power telling me this. You know, something happened to me when I was in that treatment facility in 1986. I would get up, oh no, 1987, when I went to that treatment facility. I would get up very early in the morning and I would have prayer, meditation, and journaling to my higher power. And I did have some spiritual experiences. I really did. I suffered unbelievably, like I know so many people understand what I'm saying about the food. And it had lifted. And even when I got out of the treatment facility, you know, it lifted and the binges just didn't come back to the degree and the intensity that they had before I went in. And I knew that they were coming back, but with the vengeance, even worse. So I did introduce myself on that meeting. And I grabbed hold of a recovered sponsor and I had her take me through the work. Okay, so I want to just, you know, jump around again because I opened up my talk this morning with Chapter 3, More About Alcoholism, listening to a wonderful podcast on our website. And I want to just share some things that I learned in reviewing that and how it relates to where I am today with seeing, you know, the same mind that wanted to control the food is the same mind that wants to try and control life. When I look back on those 23 years, what stands out to me is not just what I was doing, it was what was happening in my thinking. I wasn't lacking effort. I wasn't lacking knowledge. And I wasn't lacking a desire to change. I was lacking power. Something in me kept taking me back to the same place over and over again. And for a long time, I didn't understand why. I thought if I just try harder or get more control, I would finally feel okay. But what I've come to understand is that the true problem is twofold. It's the doctor's opinion talks about an allergy of the body. And Chapter 3, More About Alcoholism, shows me something just as important and maybe even more deadly, that it's my mind that takes me back over and over again. So even when I wasn't in the food, and even when I had periods of control, excuse me, something in my mind, something in my thinking was already moving back towards it. And that's exactly what Chapter 3 helped me see. Chapter 3 helped me understand something very simple but very important. The problem is not just what I do, it's how I think. And that was a huge realization for me. It helped me see that the food is not the beginning. The food is the end of a process and relapse that has already been happening in my mind. It's the last part of a relapse. And the chapter says that the great obsession of every abnormal drinker is the idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking. And for me, that's exactly true with food. So I'm referring to this 23-year period because today I'm not wanting to go back to the food, but I still struggle with my thinking. But in that period of 23 years, I wanted to control and I wanted to enjoy it without the consequences. And I really wanted to manage it and make it work and somehow have relief without paying the price. That was how my mind worked all the time. I was always trying to figure it out. And that's something that's still with me today, trying to figure it out. How do I do it differently? How do I control it? How do I get what I want and still feel safe? And what I've come to see is that, as I said, the same mind that wanted to control the food is the same mind that tries to control life. So the podcast I listened to helped me break this down in a way that really stayed with me. It described a progression, and our big book describes it as obsession, illusion, delusion, and then insanity. And when I heard that, it helped me understand my own experience much more clearly. First, there's obsession. The mind keeps circling the subject, thinking about food, thinking about how to eat it, how not to eat it, how to control it, how not to show it, how to make it safe. The mind does not let it go. Then there's the illusion, the idea that something appears true, but it is not true. And the illusion was, eventually, I'll figure this out. I'll get this under control. This time will be different. Then there's delusion, and this is even stronger. That's believing that something that is not true at all is true. So the delusion, someday I'll eat normally. Someday I'll be like other people. Someday this will not apply to me. And then comes insanity. And this is what chapter 3 makes so clear. Insanity is not just the binge. Insanity is the thinking before the compulsive bite or breaking my abstinence. It's the thought that seems reasonable at the time, the thought that says, this won't hurt. This is not a big deal. I can handle it. I know what I'm doing. And that is what the big book uses such strong language, insanity, about. Because when that thinking takes over, all my knowledge, all my promises, all my memories of suffering get pushed aside. Chapter 3 also showed me that self-knowledge is not enough. I knew about food, and I knew about consequences. I knew what happened when I crossed that line. I knew I suffered, and I still went back. So for me, the problem was not lack of information. The problem was that my mind could not reliably protect me. So, you know, at certain times, I just have no effective mental defense. And there are moments when my mind will not save me, no matter how sincere I am, no matter how much I know, no matter how badly I want relief. And that truth is both humbling and freeing. Humbling because it showed me I could not rely on myself. And freeing because it told me my real help had to come from. My defense must come from a higher power. And that's why this chapter has become so important to me. It showed me why my own thinking could not give me the safety I was looking for. And as I said, my safety, it doesn't come from my thinking. It comes from my connection with my higher power. And something that really stood out to me is how the disease begins in the mind long before the food. And that's today, being abstinent and feeling safe and protected. I see that as drifting, falling out of connection and back into self-reliance. And when I talk about this drift now here in my talk, I'm talking as a recovered person. It helps me to see how this drifting can begin, how this movement into self-reliance and away from my connection with my higher power. What I've come to understand is that that's where the problem begins. It's not in the food, as I said earlier, but in the shift in my thinking, in my spiritual condition. And the shift doesn't happen all at once. So even though I'm abstinent and feel protected in recovery, I see how that drift can begin when I'm moving out of connection and back into self-reliance. It's subtle. I don't wake up and think something is terribly wrong. What happens is much quieter than that. Something feels slightly off. I may still be doing my daily practice, my spiritual practice, my routines. I may still be praying. I may still be showing up. But inside, something begins to shift, maybe even tighten. I'm a little bit more in my head, a little bit more in my own thinking, a little less at ease. And then I begin to feel it emotionally. There is pressure, restlessness, internal strain, a feeling that I need to do something, fix something, solve something, get ahead of something. And what is so important for me today is that I don't always recognize this immediately at the beginning of a problem. It can just feel like life. It feels like I'm taking care of things. But if I slow down and look honestly, I can see what has happened. And that is that I've begun to move away from trust. I've moved back into self-reliance. And my thinking starts sounding like, I need to figure this out. I need to get clarity. I need to make sure this works out. I need to stay ahead. I can't relax until this is settled. And all of that feels reasonable, but what I've come to see is that this is the same movement of mind that used to lead me into the food, the same self-reliant mind, the same controlling mind, the same mind that wanted to control food. And that is why this matters so much to me. The difference today is not that my mind never drifts. The difference is that I can see it sooner. I don't have to follow it. Awareness is of when I move out of connection and back into self-reliance. Awareness of when the pressure in me is rising. Awareness of I'm no longer being guided, but trying to run the show. And today, when I see that happening, I can pause, I can turn, I can reconnect. I can remember that my safety does not come from my thinking. It comes from my connection with a higher power, living in the 12 steps. It doesn't start with the food. It starts with my thinking. One of the things I've had to look at in my recovery is something I hear often. The idea of being vigilant or even hypervigilant. And for a long time, I thought that's what I needed, that I needed to stay on top of everything, stay ahead of my thinking, manage my life carefully so that I wouldn't slip. And I don't really mean into the food because I haven't white knuckled for over 10 years. But what I've come to see is that for me, that way of living kept me in tension. And I've lived for many years in that braced state. But with the new chapter that I've entered into in my life, starting with the move and everything, I saw being braced. I saw that I was braced. And I can't do that anymore, you know. So it's been a process of letting that go. It kept me relying on my own thinking to try to stay safe. And something I've come to see more clearly is that hypervigilance comes from in me, but it doesn't come from peace. It comes from a place of being driven, and I know all about being driven. It comes from the same place in me that used to restrict food, that used to overexercise, that believed I needed to manage myself, my appearance, in order to be okay. And underneath that is a feeling that I haven't done enough, that I'm not enough. And when I live from that place, I don't allow myself to receive the nourishment of God's grace. It actually depletes me. And what I'm learning today is that I don't have to live from that place anymore. And what I understand today is that my safety does not come from being hypervigilant. It comes from being connected, very connected to my higher power. And from continuing to seek that connection. I heard someone say that the 12 steps are the menu, but God and my relationship with God is the meal. And that has been my experience. Because it's not just about knowing the steps, it's about living in a relationship with a higher power through the steps. Learning to trust, learning to rely on that power one day at a time. When pressure comes, and it does, I pause, I turn, I reconnect, and I allow support. And when I look at my life today, I can see the difference. I can see the difference between trying to live from my thinking and learning to live from connection in the 12 steps. I can see the difference between the internal pressure, that bracing, that trying to stay on top of everything, and what it feels like today to trust. And what I've come to understand is that I don't have to protect myself the way I used to. I don't have to stay ahead of life in order to be okay. Because the same mind that tried to protect me is the same mind that could never keep me safe. And today I have something different. As long as I have abstinence, I have a chance. Because abstinence is not a small thing. It is vital. it's, as we say, the key that gets me in the door, but it's a major key. It is what keeps me clear. And what I've learned is that if I start moving into even small behaviors, whether it's overeating on abstinent food, which I don't do, or getting into patterns of undereating, which I don't do, it's not a part of my abstinence, or introducing alcoholic ingredients, which I don't do, or engaging in behaviors like bites, licks, and tastes, it all may seem small at first, but in those moments, I am no longer serving my higher power. I'm serving the disease. And for me, it is only a matter of time. Those small shifts begin to disrupt my clarity. And when my clarity is affected, my thinking is affected. And when my thinking is affected, I become vulnerable again. Abstinence is not about control. It's about staying in a place where I can hear, feel, and respond to that connection with my higher power. It's about staying surrendered. And when I stay in that place, when I'm abstinent and continue in the steps, something happens. What I was always looking for was a sense of ease, a sense of safety, and a sense that I didn't have to manage everything in order to be okay. And the Big Book describes this so beautifully in the Step 10 Promises. It says that by this time, sanity will have returned, that we will seldom be interested. If tempted, we recoil as if from a hot flame, that we react sanely and normally, and that this has happened automatically. It says we are not fighting it, neither are we avoiding temptation. And this is the line that means so much to me, that we have been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. And that has been my experience, not because I figured it out, not because I stayed ahead of it, and not because I was hypervigilant, but because I have stayed connected to a power greater than myself. As long as I continue in that relationship, as long as I continue to live in the steps, I don't have to brace against life the way I used to. I don't have to rely on my thinking to keep me safe, because my safety does not come from my thinking. It comes from my connection. And what I'm learning one day at a time is how to live not in hypervigilance, but in trust. Thank you. I pass.
Lisa, thank you so much. So appreciative of your presentation this morning. And stick around at the end of the recorded portion this morning. We will ask Lisa for her contact information. And now we're going to transition to our Q&A. So if you have a question for Lisa, we're going to ask for your first name. Let me give the share ID before we do that, though. Share ID for the presentation this morning is 23,322. That's 23322. So now if you have a question for Lisa, press star one and give me your first name, and we'll pose some questions to Lisa. Who has a question?
This is Carly H. in Connecticut.
Carly, gotcha.
Judy.
Who else?
Judy.
Judy.
Jessica C.
Gotcha, Jessica.
Lauren Grace B., New Jersey.
We got you, Lauren Grace, as well.
Lori G.
Tara C.
Laura, was it Lori? And was that Tara with a T? Did I miss that?
That was Tamara. Tamara C.
Oh, Tamara. Hey, Tamara. Thanks. Who else?
Yes, Lori G.
Okay, gotcha, Lori.
Pete B.
Got Tamara. And gotcha, Pete. Okay, that's a good first round here, and we'll see if there's any questions beyond that. So we got, in this order, Carly, Judy, Jessica, Lauren Grace, Lori, Tamara, and Pete. So let's go ahead and mute your phone if you're not Carly. And Carly, what question do you have for Lisa? Good morning.
I think it's the crux of the whole talk is, I understand that you said that it's a subtle shift, that you're still going through all the motions, but something has disconnected, and that's where I've been for about a year. And can you explain how to get back into the grace and the connection, even though you're going through all the motions anyway? Is there something that I missed?
Oh, sure. Good morning. Thank you for your question. Well, knowing where I am in the steps was really key. So making sure, you know, that I am abstinent, that I haven't gone back into the food. So that's really key. Deepening my practice. So for me, I continued to do 10, 11, and 12, but just being very faithful with it, and diving deeper into my inventories. But, you know, I think it really helps if, are you, what step are you on right now? Like, where are you in the steps?
I've gone through the steps a number of times, and I actually am going through yet again. It, for me, it was after the death of my father that, so it just, perhaps it's just the grief.
I'm so sorry to hear about your father's passing. And I mean, I can only speak from my own experience that I knew that I was truly abstinent, because sometimes I'll talk to people and we'll have conversations about this type of thing, and then I'll find that they're in the food. You know, so of course it's going to feel really horrible, because it's really horrible to be an addict and be using the substance, and there's not going to be any clarity there. So going through the steps in a state of abstinence, you know, is always the first suggestion I give them. But if the person is abstinent and recovered, sometimes going back through the steps again is very helpful. But for me, it was just going through the process, living life and having tremendous awarenesses about the bracing, how I was bracing, and writing about it, writing inventory on it, doing deep dives through 10, 11, with fellows, with my higher power, with sponsors, and coming out through the other side and being willing to let go of those behaviors that I had been using for so long, that was all about controlling and managing. So that's the only thing I can share. I don't know if that was helpful.
It was. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Carly. Okay, next up is Judy, followed by Jessica. Judy, good morning.
Good morning. This is Judy N. from Maryland. Thank you, Lisa, so much for your share. Thank you, Larry, for your service. It just resonated with me. I don't think I've taken this many notes in a long time. You stress it's thinking. It's your thinking that has to be addressed. And your hypervigilance when you feel you have to be everything. And then this shift you talked about, but I'll get to my question. You say that when you feel this hypervigilance or this feeling of unease, you pause and you turn. I want to know exactly, because I think I've experienced that, but what exactly do you think? What's going on in your head when you're able to pause and then turn and get back to God and not your own, what's going on in your own head?
Yes, because, you know, the stuff in my head, oh my goodness, it can be such a challenge. Well, thank you for your question. So, you know, the big book on page 84, it actually gives the very clear directions on step 10 that we continue to watch for the selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. And that could show up as bracing, fearful, just all the crazy thoughts. And when these crop up, we ask God at once to remove them. We discuss them with someone immediately. We make amends quickly if we have harmed anyone. And then turning our thoughts to someone we can help. So getting out of self. So that's my practice. Meditation, really learning to meditate, has been so helpful for me. It's almost easier to learn to meditate and stop that thought, even if it's just for like a second or two at a time, versus just to not think about one thing and try and think about something else, because I don't really have any control over my thoughts. I mean, my thoughts can be crazy. So meditating has been very helpful, and doing 10 steps and following the directions in the big book. And I have found journaling this past, you know, chapter that I'm in to be so helpful, and learning a lot about just the different parts of myself that I used for so long to cope and manage. And I'll share, sometimes I'll share, you know, the journaling with others, but a lot of times it's just me getting closer to my higher power. But step 10, following the directions, and the 11th step, and turning my thoughts to others, and the 12th step. So I hope that helps you.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks, Judy. Okay, next up we have Jessica, followed by Lauren Grays. Jessica, good morning.
Hi, Larry. Good morning. Hi, Lisa. Wow, that was incredible. Thank you so much. I could really relate to all of it, especially when you talked about hypervigilance and, you know, thinking, you know, I definitely have that trait, and I am, you know, thinking obsessively about a topic or something that needs to get done. In some ways, that hypervigilance has been, you know, useful. It helped me get through the steps quickly, for example. And so, you know, this fear that the ball is going to get dropped if I'm not hypervigilant, you know, I guess I want to ask you about how you manage, how you surrender that, I guess. Because, you know, life starts to feel really small, I have realized, when I'm constantly vigilant, and that I could be experiencing more joy. So yeah, I'd love to hear about how you deal with the fear of things not getting done, I guess, without that hypervigilance.
Well, thank you, Jessica. It's nice to hear you, and I appreciate you asking your question. I so relate to what you shared. Yes, the hypervigilance has really gotten me through in life and enabled me to do a lot of really great things and get things done. And so, yes, I really trust everything is in my higher power's hands. You know, the growth, my spiritual growth, my growth in life. It's like God decides, okay, now is the time for you to see that hypervigilance can also be your enemy. And I just, with his grace, I'm learning not to beat myself up about it. And it's like, okay, I really didn't want to have that lesson. I fought it, and the bracing and the tension, it then starts to show up in my body and my physical well-being, or lack of physical well-being. And I'm brought to my knees. It's like, oh my goodness. I mean, I have to surrender this. I have to learn a whole new way of how to go through life without trying to get out ahead of it, and brace, and manage and control. And you know what? The whole idea is to let more of God's grace come in. And I saw that that was so difficult for me. It was difficult for me to sit and let God's grace wash over me as I released these things. And it's much more comfortable just to, like, let me get up and just do. Let me be like a human doing and do this, do that, manage that. And then I don't have to feel this discomfort. But the way things worked, I was forced to just have to submit and surrender to hypervigilance is not my friend anymore. It doesn't mean like I'm full of sloth and procrastination. I guess I'm balanced, but just God in his grace, kind of like when I was standing in that AA meeting, and it was like my higher power spoke to me and said, you need to get on that OA meeting. And that was all those years later. And it's like God decides, you know, what door is going to be opened, what door is going to be closed, and what lesson I'm going to be learning and releasing. And it's usually not a pleasant experience, but I think the struggle is what makes it so difficult. So being forced on my knees to just surrender this, and now when I sit in meditation, I am taking more in from my higher power than I was, because I'm releasing more. It's just wonderful. So I'm allowing more by not doing all that stuff. And I'm trusting more. I'm just trusting the flow of things. And it's just wonderful. I know it all sounds kind of airy-fairy. And that's why I was a little concerned about the talk, because it can sound airy-fairy. But this is my experience, and this is what I felt led to share on. So I hope that gives a little bit of clarity there for you. I pass.
Thanks, Jessica. Okay, we got Lauren Grace followed by Lori. Hey, Lauren Grace, good morning to you.
Good morning. This is Lauren Grace, a grateful recovered compulsive overeater. Thank you so much, Lisa, for this beautiful talk. I could relate so much to it. I could go on and on, but I won't. My question is, how do you help your sponsees connect with their higher power if they don't have one, or if their concept of a higher power is not working well for them and they don't feel that God can be trusted?
Well, that's a great question. Well, I think kind of along the lines of what I've been learning with this whole talk is doing less. Like, I really can't make people. All I can do is share my experience, strength, and hope, and trust that they will have their process. So I love staying in the big book with people and not veering out of it, because it's like the template is right here, you know, to follow. And I know that for me, I had a very strong experience going through the steps, and I can share that. And, you know, in the chapter Working with Others, you know, it talks about somewhere like we really, we don't want to say anything. I'm looking for it right now, but I just was reading it the other day. You had better use everyday, plain, everyday language to describe spiritual principles. There is no use arousing any prejudice you may have. So, you know, don't raise such issues no matter what your own convictions are. And then it goes on to talk about your prospect may belong to this. But even if they don't belong to the religious denomination and they're agnostic, it's fine. We just go through the work, and I openly refer to my higher power as God. I'm fine with that. That's what the big book says. You know, they use the word God, and it's just easier for me to say God rather than my higher power, you know, every time. And they don't have to have that, but I let the steps do the work. Like, let the steps work them, you know, and I just am a guide to try and share my experience and hold a flashlight. But I give it to God. I give it to my higher power. Anytime I work with someone, I just say, you know, let me be effective and useful. Thy will be done, not mine. And I don't know how long I'm in their life for. You know, it could be a day. It could be 6 months or years. So who knows? But I have total faith in the 12 steps as it's laid out in the big book. It's just an amazing process. So I hope that helps.
Yeah, thanks, Lauren Grace. Okay, we have Lori followed by Tamara. Lori, good morning to you.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
You bet.
All right. Thanks. This is Lori G. in Colorado. You may have, first of all, thank you, Larry, for your service, and thank you, Lisa, for a beautiful, wonderful talk. I am very inspired, and you may have already answered this, so if you have, you can just say that, but I'm kind of wondering, let's see, how do I put it? How do you kind of guard against getting complacent or getting, like you said, your mind starts kind of wanting you to drift off? I'm paraphrasing, I guess, but I've been recovered for several years. I've been in program for 30 years, and not the same number, but anyway, I tend to go through these cycles where I think I'm doing great, and then I kind of start getting distracted or getting complacent or lazy or whatever. And so, yeah, does that make sense?
It sure does. Thank you so much for your question. Well, I just love the daily disciplines of 10 and 11. So I just am in touch with that little angst. If it starts to come up or just waking up feeling off, I go right into my morning practice of prayer and meditation and reading and journaling and connecting with fellows through the day, both recovered and newcomers, sponsees, and sharing what's going on. But trusting, you know, that things can pass and some are just part of life, just the flow of life. Some days are just kind of low days, you know, and but getting out of self really helps. But I would say if it is lingering, I definitely talk about it. I journal, I talk about it, I pray about it. Before I make an outreach call, I always pray, God, you know, help me to see whatever it is I need to see. Is there something that I'm doing, some thought pattern or some behavior? And just help me to connect and hear you and sharing with fellows. And sometimes I don't share. I just journal, just go through my day, you know, work and with family and still making outreach calls, but not really talking much about myself, you know. And, but I think being active in the steps every day is key and having a fellowship around me. You know, the fellowship is about the solution of the big book and connecting with fellows regularly, not having any, even one day where I don't connect with someone, you know, I don't make a habit of that. So I think working with others, sponsoring, taking them through the work. I think doing the directions in the big book, a written nightly review every day really helps me. As I said, my morning practice, pausing through the day, you know, asking for the next right thought, the next right action. Doing service on meetings, you know, am I in the middle of the herd, sharing on the meetings, reaching out and doing service. So, yeah, and making sure that my food is clean. You know, that's another thing. You know, just making sure. That's been so key for me. Not that I'm, like, watching it and guarding it and all that. I don't. I don't do that at all. But I just don't make changes on my food plan without talking about it with someone. And it's amazing how those little behaviors can creep in. And it does start to make my head feel crazy. I love the silence and the peace that I have. I got that from getting entirely abstinent and going through the doctor's opinion with my sponsor. From that point on, it was like silence. Just stop fooling around with the food, which I had been doing for so long. It just keeps like this constant buzz noise in my head, and it just takes me out of serenity. So I value that so much. So grateful for that. So I hope that long, choppy, varied answer helped you.
That was wonderful. Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks so much. Okay, we have Tamara followed by Pete, and then we'll see if there's more questions. Tamara, good morning. Tamara, press star one.
Thank you. Thank you for your service, Larry. And Lisa, thank you so much for sharing your experience, strength, and hope. I couldn't believe it. I felt like you were just describing so well, like, what drives my thinking. And just that sense of not good enough, I have to do better. I have to fix my thinking. And so my question is, when you, because you're recovered and you're doing your spiritual practices and you see that drift toward I need to manage more, and then you pause and allow support, will you share with me, is there any like common message that you get that replaces those old fixed ideas?
Oh, thank you, Tamara. That's such a good question. Well, yeah, a lot of it is like fear,
But I'm telling you, I've just had to learn to journal a lot, especially in the past, like since October of last year when we moved. We just moved 4 miles away from our house. And I didn't think it was going to be such an upheaval, but boy, it was. But it's all good. Such a great, I mean, I'm really loving that we moved. But it just brought up so much. And I said to a fellow the other day, I never moved in a state of abstinence and being recovered, you know. So anytime we've moved, I was always, you know, in the food and all that. So everything is just all hanging out. I'm so aware of things. And it just, I've learned to journal and deepen my meditation and slow down and let God be there. Let that hug of my higher power be there for me. And it comes just in silence. And it's like I've wanted to try and communicate this stuff to someone. I haven't even been able to put it in the words, but that's okay. I just let it be there. But a lot of times it's just pure fear. Fear that I'm just not enough, that I'm just not enough. I don't measure up. I'm so used to trying to fix that, you know, somehow fix it so that I can feel, you know, the self-seeking. And that's why I love in the big book where one of the prayers, you know, we ask God to divorce our thoughts from self-pity, dishonest, and self-seeking motives. And those three things are so key for me every day. Just this morning in my prayer and meditation and journaling, it came out like the self-pity. It's like a warm blanket I throw around myself, and it's really comforting. It's like taking pleasure in a bag of potato chips or something, you know, and I can't do that. I can't do that. So I got to throw that blanket down and just give it to God and learn to just go through without the self-pity, without using self-pity, you know. And then the self-seeking. I see self-seeking throughout the day so much at work, like wanting recognition. It's like this little bratty voice inside of me says, look at what I've done. If you knew how hard this was, you know, it's still that voice that says, if you knew how hard this was, you know, you would eat too. And that's what I used to say all the time in my own head. And that voice is still there. You know, that's the other thing with this whole journey of this talk and getting ready for it. The disease really does reside still in my unconscious. So I'm not always aware of it. And that's why the eating behaviors and stuff are so key, because those behaviors, it's the disease trying to bring me back to the food so I would get relief and ease and comfort. That's why I like knowing what my abstinence is as far as my behaviors too, you know, is so key, because it's operating in me like this machine, this AI or something machine inside of me that's like bringing me closer, you know, to those things if I'm not in a continual surrendered state. And it's not like I have to be hypervigilant and be so afraid of it and be watching. It's not like that at all. But just knowing who and what I'm dealing with, it's this disease and how it is a very big thing, and it's insidious and it's still alive and running, but it's now in remission. I always say, and I know I will get to this, and I know there's other questions that are going to be coming up, but I always say it's like when I term the disease as like a monster that hides under my porch, and I have to go down the steps every day, you know, where that porch is, and I don't know if it's going to grab me and pull me in. Am I going to be able to get out, you know? But today I do live safe and protected with my higher power, and it's wonderful, and it's such a place of grace. And I want to keep that. And the disease, it's like still operating in the unconscious. So that's why this whole journey has been a lot of learning and seeing those things that drive me. Fear that I won't be able to do it, that I'm not enough. And I have to surrender those fears in an inventory, share it with a fellow, go to that fear prayer. God, please remove these fears and direct my attention to what you would have me be. Doing the seventh step prayer, trusting that I will have the strength with God's power, and he'll decide, you know, when those character defects are removed. But I go forward in faith, just like it talks about in the big book, in the fear part, you know, and how it works. So I know it's so hard sometimes when people ask questions,
And I know I veered off a little bit there, but I'm happy to talk to you privately on the phone too if you ever want to call.
Thanks, Tamara. All right, next up, I don't know if he's a Philly fan, but hey, Pete, good morning.
Larry, thank you. I'm gonna omit what I'm a fan of, but appreciate it. So thank you for taking the meeting, Larry. You do a great job. And Lisa, thank you so much. It was really good and calming and articulate. And so you indicated that it was your thinking that that brought you to a binge, or that would bring you to a binge. So are you saying it's your thinking that triggers the phenomena of craving?
No, the thinking, it can start and then eventually, you know, lead me to the food, just like in the chapter more about alcoholism talks about. But no, the phenomena of craving is once I ingest that alcoholic ingredient. The way the craving
shows
is seeing more, wanting more. Yeah.
Thanks, Pete. Okay. Well, we have time. If you have a question for Lisa, again, it's L-E-S-A if you're looking for her, but we'll get her contact information. But anyways, press star one if you have a question. Who else would like to pose a question to Lisa?
Elizabeth B.
Gotcha, Elizabeth. Anybody else? I'm going to throw
Linda
myself
R.
on the list here. Linda?
Linda R. Yes.
Gotcha, Linda. Okay, anybody else? All right. Well, we'll go Elizabeth, Linda, and I'll throw myself in there as well. So go ahead, Elizabeth, with a question for Lisa. Good morning.
Thank you, Larry. And thanks for your service and for everyone who does on the work from the meeting. And Lisa, thank you so much. I was a Lisa B as well in high school. So I've been listening to you share for the last 3 years since I've been coming to A Vision for You. And I relate a lot to what you shared. And the piece that I wanted to ask you about in terms of how you define your abstinence today is around exercise. I was an exercise bulimic and anorexic, and following a weight measured food plan today with restrictions around exercise, because that is a way that I seek to feel back in control and to feel safe. So that's my question. What are your parameters around exercise? And I'll pass.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks for the question. You know, I do not compulsively exercise. I think, you know, what I've had to learn is to accept the limitations of my body and what I'm able to do. And it's very important that I do have exercise for health reasons. Just, you know, different doctors are wanting me to be making sure that I'm exercising and doing that. And so I do, but I do not compulsively exercise because of injuries that I've had in the past, and it's just so not worth it for me, you know, to have those setbacks. So, and I can tell when there is that, anytime there is a drive for something, it's just never a good thing. And it's always like the white flag comes out immediately, you know, whether it's something I'm watching. Even like my husband and I sometimes will enjoy a series on TV about something or on Netflix. And it's like, you know, I'll say to him, I'm just not going to watch this anymore, because I start feeling too into it, you know, too driven. And I just don't. And it's the same with exercise. It's the same with shopping. Thank God I do not compulsively shop, and I haven't for 10 years. Well, I have to take that back. I just realized that when we moved, I was starting to like peruse the websites a little bit for shopping with cosmetics. I did get into a little thing where, like, well, I was just shopping all the time looking at these cosmetics, and then I had to stop. But yeah, I feel it. I feel when the drive comes and I don't do it. And I don't do that with the exercise. I stay within the parameters that the people that are guiding me do. And my dietitian also is aware of it and has directives for me. So I hope that helps. I pass.
Yeah, thanks, Elizabeth. Okay, we have Linda And then I'll jump in there as well. Linda, good morning. Linda, star one.
Hi, thank you, Larry. I'm just so grateful for your service on the line and Lisa for your qualification today. Anyway, I related to a lot of it. My question for you is that you shared that you had open bypass surgery. How did you get through that one? And then how would you deal with like waiting for a diagnosis? I mean, I heard what you said spiritually, you know, I get that, but I'm just wondering if you have a different approach, like when you're waiting for something physical and, you know, how you get out. I know for me, sometimes I get fearful about results of physical things. So how do you deal with that? Thanks.
Well, thank you, Linda. Well, the heart surgery happened before I got recovered. So, I mean, that was really tough, but, you know, I got through it. And, you know, the interesting thing is right when I got abstinent and was on the food plan, my body started to heal properly. The doctors kept saying to me, you know, you're not really healing the way we want to see you healing because I wasn't on a healthy way of eating. And right when I got on the food plan and started working my OA program, it's like my body just started healing and thriving. So that was key. And I go into major stress with things like that, what you're asking. And just talking to people, praying, meditating, doubling up on my meetings, staying close to my support people around me, getting out of self, making gratitude lists, praying for others that are worse off, and, you know, really dedicating time each day to pray for others, I think is key. That really helps me a lot, and gratitude, trusting God. I love that what I hear someone say, you know, I love you, I trust you, I know I'm yours, you know, you've got me. There's just trusting that God is there in charge. Yeah, so I hope that helps you, but I'll be praying for you for sure.
Yeah,
thanks,
Linda. Yeah, you bet. Well, we got a final question. We got a dope over here in Chicago. I was thinking, Lisa, you did such a wonderful job. And it's sort of along the lines of Linda, but a little different. So you there you were, and I don't know the sequence of it all, Lisa, but you had kind of a trifecta of things. You mentioned the heart surgery, the death of a brother, father, stepmother, all in kind of succession, and then the panic attacks, and which I can relate to in my past. And so there you were. And I guess my question is, if you could sit down with that younger woman today and support and talk to her, you know, in the midst of all the uncertainty of what recovery is and isn't and all that stuff, like, what would you tell her? Have you ever thought about that? Or I don't know if that makes sense.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's a great question. I do think about that. I do. Because if I had known that putting the food down, getting abstinent, getting recovered would be so good. I mean, it's not like everything is perfect and there's no problems. There are problems and everything is not perfect. But it's just so wonderful to have the freedom to come and go where I want. You know, I do walk a free person, just like what we've been reading in the big book on our meetings. I don't have to have a bodyguard. I have neutrality with food. I never thought in a million years I would have neutrality with food. I mean, I just thought this is going to be something that I carry with me for the rest of my life. I'm just going to live and die with it, you know. I had no idea that it would be a transformation in thought, mood, attitude, perception, outlook, because that's what I would say to her. And, you know, I said to my husband the other day, so I'm going to be 63 in May, and so he's going to be 75 in August, and we've been married 33 years, and I said to him, you know, gosh, what if the next 20 years are the very best 20 years ever? And I hope and pray, you know, that each of us live a long time. But I do believe that. It's like we have an amazing way of life, just a connection with my higher power, a source of power, a higher power, the highest power, having a relationship with that power, feeling that love of that power is so wonderful. And the clarity in my mind, like that's what I would say to her, you know, because I just never had clarity. And I think I just always had this anxiety, this undercurrent of anxiety and fear and trepidation, just not fitting in, feeling like I'm not fitting in. I still often don't quite feel like I fit in. I'm still like really cautious about, you know, what people think of me, wanting to know what people think of me, but I just keep giving that to God. But I don't know, it just gets better and better and better. And that's why I said earlier, as long as I have abstinence, you know, I have a chance. And I know that we always say, you know, abstinence isn't the most important thing. But, oh, I suffered terribly with the food. But abstinence is such an amazing gift. And I feel like as long as I've got that, then I have a chance to, like, have that recovery with the steps, you know, because I am able to absorb the effect of the steps to take over and change me. So I hope that helps a little bit.
Oh God, yeah. Yeah, I can relate to it all. Yeah, thank you so much, Lisa. We're gonna end with that and so very thankful for your time this morning. Such a gem for the archives that we appreciate. And I'll give you guys the share ID number again. Stick around at the end of the recorded portion. We'll ask Lisa for her contact information. So that's coming. But the share ID number for Lisa's presentation is 23,322. That's 23322. And again, it's Lisa. I said it a couple of times. I'll say it again. It's spelled, if you're looking for Lisa in South Carolina, you're going to find her first name spelled L-E-S-A. L-E-S-A. So appreciate that. Appreciate everyone being here. So we're going to close now with reading from the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous on page 164, which I will get open here. Usually have that open, but not this morning. Okay. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order, but obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.